Okay, as you can see, I come with strings attached. So I'd like to thank the organizers. I know how hard it is to do what they did and get all the, it's like herding rabbits and to come to the right place at the right time. And so I initially was going to talk about something totally different because my recent passion is the effects of the sex hormone relaxin in the heart, and which has causes an enormous number of genomic effects and suppresses atrial fibrillation, is a potential therapy for heart failure, and we are just touching the tip of the iceberg on all the things that it does. And so I had a request from Flavio to talk about that, but looking at the talks and the central topic of this particular group, I decided to go back to something else, which is and calcium dynamics. And now this is a different take from what you've heard so far, in the sense that we are going to be talking about six differences in the long QT syndrome. And why the long QT syndrome and sex differences. It's not that I'm wedded to sex differences, although it's not a bad thing, but it brings to bear how important calcium is once more. And so hopefully I will convince you of that. And then we're going to talk about mapping of voltage and action potentials, but not with confocal microscopes, but with water immersion objectives that can give you a 2D image at the subcellular level, about 1.5 by 1.5 microns. But in this case, you're going to be able to see more of the subcellular phenomena in one shot with a high-speed camera. And those are the typical ones you've heard before, the CMOS cameras. And so we will then try to argue with you that the only way you're going to get an EAD that is strong enough and powerful enough to kick an arrhythmia, and this is something that that was brought out very beautifully in the first talk of this meeting, and what is the requirement for a stochastic effect like calcium to be released and to cause an arrhythmia? What does it take for this to happen? If it's stochastic, it should just die off and nothing should come of it. And I will show you that perhaps the reason why it does happen is synchronization of this calcium release, and this is a key function of that. And in order to demonstrate that this happens, we have a recent publication in Chaos. Again, it was the impetus was Flavio asking us to submit it ASAP on the special issue. And in that case, you have to postulate that the ranadine receptor has three gates in order to predict the experimental data that we're able to get. All right, so what is the long QT syndrome? The long QT syndrome is really very simple. The QT interval on the EKG gets longer. And there are many different ways that this can happen, but the central discovery from a number of very illustrious molecular biologists is that there are mutations in certain channels. I'm not going to talk about all the long QT forms of the long QT syndrome. There isn't enough time in the 10 days to do that. But what we'll talk about is long QT type 2. Long QT type 2 is a mutation or a loss of function of the Hurg channel, which is the repolarizing potassium current that is delayed, but is the dominant repolarizing current of the action potential. And so these are channel dysfunctions, all the forms of long QT. So this is very different from the type of situation that was described for heart failure, where you have disruption of T-tubules, you have changes in morphology of cells, fibrosis. None of this happens here. This is strictly an electrical problem. Okay, so that, in fact, simplifies the situation a great deal in terms of what it is you think is happening chronically, because this can be induced acutely. So why do I look at long QT type 2? In my opinion, it's the most important form of long QT to be studied and considered. Hurg is a very promiscuous channel. It interacts with everything. So there's lists of all of the agents, pharmacological agents for neurological therapies, antibiotics, antihistamines, a long, long list of compounds that suppress this current. And they produce long QT, and they all have the potential to produce lethal arrhythmias. And so now the FDA requires any new drug on the market must be tested for its effect on the action potential duration. And if it increases QT interval by 5 milliseconds, which is your resolution, then they slap on you tons of studies that you have to perform in order to consider the drug further. Drug companies throw it in the garbage. They don't bother. When that happens, they stop studying a particular agent. And hopefully this will change their mind that there are other things to be considered. So what is the other things that promote? It's not enough just to have an inhibition of the IKR current. There are other factors that push it from being asymptomatic to kicking a lethal arrhythmia. The amount of drug blockade, that's obvious. Electrolyte disturbances have a big impact, particularly potassium and magnesium, and that's also in the clinical literature. And bradycardia, so the slowing down of the heart rate makes it worse. And patients with congenital forms of the disease can be asymptomatic for decades. They don't even know they have the disease, and then they can drop dead. And this keeps happening. And so we don't know to what extent you must test them for mutations. Mutations occur that can be essentially neutral. They don't have a serious effect. And sex. And sex is one of the most dominant factors in long QT type 2. 70% of women have to 30% in terms of risk of torsade de pointe. And this is a very powerful statistic in the clinical literature. So what is the mechanism? You have a normal action potential duration. This essentially produces an EKG on the intact heart. And if you now lower magnesium or lower potassium or increase cycle length, meaning you slow down heart rate, and drugs, and the drug inhibits IKR, that prolongs the action potential duration. This increase in action potential duration gives you an increase in dispersion throughout the surface of the heart, so that areas have long and other areas have short action potential durations. This effect causes triggered activity, so the combination of triggered activity plus heterogeneity of action potential duration results in reentrant forms of arrhythmia and a classical oscillatory EKG called torsade de pointe. So we studied this in a number of ways for a number of years, but one other thing that's really striking, if you have a calcium and voltage recording from the surface of a rabbit Langendorf perfused heart, and then you add an IKR blocker, it could be dofetilide, E431, which was a Pfizer therapeutic drug that they call antiarrhythmic. And when they went to clinical trials, they said, nah, this is pro-arrhythmic and not antiarrhythmic. And I know a lot of people who lost their jobs, who were patch clampers and voltage clampers, working in outside Philadelphia in Valley Forge. And when that result came in, they all lost their jobs overnight. It was a catastrophe. But
it is a single cell?
This, no. It's a rabbit, Langendorf perfused heart, and this is one of the pixels on the heart.
And this is B-panel, it's also from the same point after you give the drug, or what is it?
Yeah, then you add the drug. So, well, first thing you see, the actual potential duration gets longer. And the actual potential doesn't show any electrical abnormality. It looks really normal. Long, true, but otherwise, no irregularities. But look at the calcium that is being recorded from the same spot. It goes from being essentially monophasic rise and pretty much a monophasic fall, although there's a little bit of changes here, and then I will talk more about this in a minute. But when you go to a faster sweep speed, you see clear oscillation, then the action potential is pretty normal.
And this is pacing very slow,
Yes.
It's a pace of breakthrough.
For a rabbit, that's slow. So a rabbit is at 120 beats a minute, and we are probably going, so slow rate for the rabbit is 50 beats, and you start getting the effects. Yeah, Elena?
Do you think this, the absence of this oscillatory artifact in the voltage is an artifact of optical mapping because it's just average electrical activity?
No, it's not. Not my voltage sensitive dye.
Okay.
That's an insult. I'm doing this at very high resolution.
Okay.
We're talking just a few cells. But I'll show you much greater detail. I'm just trying to cross a message here. And the message is you are going to have no electrical disturbances that are visible, and the calcium disturbances happen very fast, immediately.
This very long action potential has something on
yes.
top.
That's the bradycardia. That, yeah.
This has notches. Let's say three or four notches, the longest.
Here?
No, it's the next one.
The third one.
Oh, yeah, this is the development of torsades. Now, I'm showing you the progression of the arrhythmia. When you add the drug, it doesn't bang give you an arrhythmia. You got to wait a few minutes. Depending on how much drug you add, if you change electrolytes, so you can get a very quick transition from normal to torsade, or you can have it slower.
And the drug is what?
Dofetilide. It's a clinical drug. I'm not talking about a mysterious poison. People who have atrial fibrillation are treated with dofetilide to prolong their atrial action potential.
Do you know how much dofetilide you have to give to see its effect?
This is half a micromolar, but I can add less. It's just how long you want to wait for the effect.
And you're giving it from coronary perfusion?
Yes, absolutely, coronary perfusion. Okay, so the point of this slide was to focus on you're going to have electrical abnormality, no electrical abnormalities. You start out to understand the initiation of the arrhythmia. I want to see its progression. I want to see how does it start. And if once the thing is gone and it's firing like this on the EKG, it's hard to say what happened first, where on the heart, what caused it. Okay, so this is very dependent on calcium. Because if I do a control voltage calcium, add dofetilide, I wait and I get my arrhythmia, and I add nifedipine, suppress the L current, I go back. So it's calcium influx can be suppressed, and I can stop this arrhythmia. Another way here is control, it's different hearts, so they don't look identical, and you will learn more about this structure in a minute. And then you have the arrhythmia, you have low calcium instead of one millimolar, 1.5 millimolar calcium in the buffer, you drop it to 0.2, and you stop the rapid torsade. So what is going on here? The first thing you notice is that we were studying rabbits, and the reason why we want to study the rabbit is essentially because they have similar balance of IKR, IKS as the human. The guinea pig does not, has a lot of IKS all the time. The IKS current in the rabbit is suppressed until you add adrenaline to the system. It has the same ratio of sodium-calcium exchanger. And this was the work of Jost and András Varro in Hungary, where they studied human and other animal species in great detail. And in their view, this is the best mode to study. Also, studies by Carlson showed that the rabbit showed marked sex differences in the heart. Okay, so what did we do? We were studying female hearts. And we were adding E4031. E4031 was one of the Pfizer genius class 3 antiarrhythmics, which failed. It's only used for experiments now. It's not used clinically ever. And again, half a micromolar. oh, this is sort of faded, but it's really the coloring. But here's a normal action potential. You add E431, bang, you get the typical oscillatory torsade de pointe. If you go to the male and you add E431, look what happens. You get funny stuff here. Early EADs, early depolarization, the action potential is very long. These are seconds, right? So these action potentials are 1/2 seconds. And there's no arrhythmia.
And this is the body temperature.
Oh, please, yes. So the hearts are perfused with saline solution, physiological. We have to pay very close attention to osmolarity. Okay? And this is 37 degrees, and we are spot on here. We measure with a thermistor the temperature across the surface of the heart. If you don't, you can have gradients of temperature in the chamber where you're making the measurement. And so you're going to have heterogeneities of action potential duration just due to temperature. And I'm going to be talking a lot about heterogeneities of action potential duration. So you have to accept that we are very cautious with that particular point. So the chamber is not open to air. It is sealed. There's a temperature thermistor in the chamber to auto-control temperature. And we study that with a roving thermistor, which measure temperature at different locations along the surface of the heart. And that's the surface where the glass is pushed, is to give us a curvature. But there'll be other experiments where there is no glass. I'll explain that in a minute. And in that case, you need to check temperature because of this very strong temperature sensitivity. In fact, all the calcium transporters, and you have circa, sodium calcium exchanger, you're going to have a very high Q10 compared to the L current, for example. The sodium potassium pump, all your electrolytes are going to go crazy unless you have good temperature control. Great point. Yeah. Okay, so here, what I wanted to show you is this marked difference between a male rabbit and a female rabbit. And for a long time, we were working with female, but we were using animals that were too young. And in pre-puberty, if you have a control, you add E431, there is no arrhythmia. You can wait hours. Nothing will happen. And here, you'll get this arrhythmia within 5 minutes. And we were wondering, what in the world is going on? This model stinks. It doesn't make arrhythmias. And we must have done 24 of those until we realized they were too young. Too young means that they are at the age before they have a surge in estrogen. And the surge of estrogen occurs at day 49 to 52 in the rabbit. In the human, it's 13. That's when you have your bar mitzvah. You become, you're not an adult at 13, but what you are is mature sexually. You can make a baby at 13, but not before. And so the same thing for these rabbits. But now if you give E4031 to a prepubertal male, bang, beautiful torsade. Okay, so this sex is, if you don't know that sex is important for the heart, that should dissuade you of that. Okay, what is the torsade like?
But Guy, what's the implication that it flips?
That is what?
So male, female, pre-puberty, no surge of estrogen or
testosterone, yes.
Why do they prefer pre-puberty?
Why do they not have arrhythmias before?
No, they flip.
Yes.
Why?
No one knows. I don't know, but I haven't found anybody else who had a good answer. So the XY chromosomes actually send hormonal-like signals from the actual gene that may in fact have hormonal-like significance. By the way, this effect is the same in men. And you're not going to see this, at least there's no evidence that this happens in other animal species, in other mammals. Now, Zareba and Arthur, Wojciech Zareba at Rochester, and Arthur Moss have, I think he passed away, but they had a international registry of long QT patients, and they were tabulating all the information throughout the world of different patients with different types of ion channel mutations. And what they reported is that in puberty, in pre-puberty, as described here in people, there was no difference in cardiac events and hospitalization between boys and girls. And then we wrote a paper saying there's a big difference in the rabbit. And then they came back and said, well, they should have paid attention to mortality. The boys die 3-to-1 ratio compared to girls with LQT2 and LQT1 type mutations. And that the fact they then wrote another paper on Goldberg that came out saying that, yes, in children, the boys have greater lethality than the girls. And after the surge of estrogen and testosterone, it flips. So question is, yeah, isn't that interesting, though, that these things happen? Oh, I was showing you a torsade. This is a voltage, delta psi, there's some physicists here, and calcium. And what you see here is that there's two spots that rise abruptly. Let's see, there's... So what you see is a jump and another jump. Two abrupt depolarizations that are occurring out of phase. The reason why I like to show this is because Desertin in 1966 coined the word torsade de pointe. And he proposed that this oscillatory type of signal on the EKG is due to two depolarizing triggers that are out of phase. And he was right. That's what we also see. That's basically what is happening. So what is the mechanism? What's happening and why the large heterogeneities are changes in calcium handling required in addition to APD? And why does the QT prolongation elicit EADs and arrhythmias in the adult female but not in the male? So we started to try to understand what is the initial kick for this arrhythmia. And this is a cartoon of an area of the view, the interior surface of the heart that we were imaging at the time, with right ventricle, left ventricle, base, and apex. What we mean here by the base is basically the region of the ventricle that are the largest in diameter. So that's the region of the heart that is going to shorten and contract the most compared to the apex, which is essentially has no place to contract. But what we saw here is that in the earliest EEDs in the adult female hearts, we're always at these sites here. And these sites were basically near the base of the heart. I couldn't tell you a specific spot, but they're not going to happen below the midline, for example. They don't start there. They start up here. And if you go to the prepubertal male, and because these have reliable arrhythmias, when you do this kind of experiment, the same thing happened. They were around here. So something happens around here that's different here than down here.
There's the natural gradient in the body. It's like the APD, as you go to the to the apex, it gets smaller.
Right. So in the rabbit, IKR is higher here than here. So repolarization is this way, mainly because it's driven by the action potential repolarization of the cells here than here. And we had done this in great detail in the guinea pig before, and we didn't repeat it here in the rabbit. What we did do is take tissue here and here and run Western blots. And you can and other people have done that too. We're not the only ones who were able to verify that there are more channel proteins of IKR at the base, at the apex than the base. IKS is the opposite. IKS is high here and low here. IKS is high where the sympathetic nerves come in, because the sympathetic nerves don't go all the way down. And if you don't have sympathetic activation, IKS is virtually not measurable. So that's the K heterogeneity. So what we did next is to take tissues here from the epicardium, from the base, and we took cells from here and cells from here and compared them to see what's different about them. So the first thing you see is that the male base has less current, L current, than the female. And this is the current to voltage relationship. This is our statistics, at least 6 animals per group. And if you look at the apex, male and female are virtually the same. Current to voltage relationship, it's no significant change. The statistics, not this, it's the same. So basically something happens. The female heart has more L current at the base, but not at the apex. Now if you go to the prepubertal, then it's the male that has the higher current, and the male that has the arrhythmia in the prepubertal mode. Again, at the apex, there was no significant difference. So where do these differences in current come from? We isolated tissues and we ran some Western blots, male-female apex, male-female base. Look at the big difference in the female compared to the male. And the child protein is CAV1.2 alpha in the rabbit. And it's a very similar isoform in men. And so in the prepubertals, it's the opposite. The males have more protein than the female. And so you can argue that the reason why there's more current is because there is more channels. Why is there more channels? So if you take cells, you isolate the cells, and you measure them at day one. And you see the control is approximately here, 8 picoampere picofarad. It goes to approximately 14, 15 if you add estrogen. So we added estrogen, and we added 1 nanomolar estrogen. And we bathed the cells in estrogen and measured the current on day 0, 1, 2, and 3 to see how estrogen impacts on the current. And what you see is that if you don't have estrogen, there's a slight drop in the current, but if you have estrogen in the bath, the actual current significantly rises and increases. If the cell is from the base, if you do the same thing with the cell from the apex, there is no effect. So estrogen has an effect on cells from the base of the heart and not the apex of the heart.
Were those female cells or
yes.
Males? Yeah, okay.
These are females. The male doesn't respond to estrogen.
Okay,
so now we want to know how does estrogen do that. If you block estrogen with ICI, which is an agent called fulvestrant, it's an inhibitor of the estrogen receptors. There are 2 estrogen receptors, ER alpha and ER beta. This one blocks all of them, so if you have a control over here, these are the open dot, estrogen increases the current to voltage relationship. If you then add fulvestrant, you totally block the effect. So estrogen is working through its receptors. Which receptor is shown here? Basically, instead of using estrogen, we use activators of ER alpha, ER beta, DPN, and if you add the 2 together, you get the same result. So basically, this agent, VPT, which is in the reproductive endocrinology literature, so it's used in many different types of studies, it activates ER alpha, and this has the same effect as estrogen. So here's control, estrogen, inhibition, this is control, activation of ER alpha. So ER alpha appears to be the culprit. This is verified because if you look at the promoter region of the DNA for CAV1.2 alpha, it has 8 response elements for ER alpha and none for ER beta. So ER alpha binding to estrogen will go into the nucleus, promote an increase in message level and protein. We did all of this legwork. Some of it is shown here. Estrogen enhances the expression of CAB1.2 alpha. This is isolated cells where we treat them essentially. A is the control at the apex, and if you then treat it with estrogen, there's basically no difference. If you then have a base cell, C, and then you treat it with estrogen, you see an increase in protein in the cell. So that's essentially the evidence. If you also block transcription with actinomycin D, you block the effect of estrogen. In other words, the current requires de novo transcription and de novo translation to work. So there is a change. And it takes 24 hours for the effect to occur. This is not an acute instantaneous effect. This is an effect that takes a certain amount of time. Okay, now I'm going to switch gears on you. Yeah.
So the estrogen, what you're describing is the transcription level, how it modulates the calcium channel. I guess in the females, you get double hit because estrogen as a molecule acts directly on the IKR pore. It competes and blocks that pore.
I've never seen that.
Actually, it's well established in the literature.
I know the literature, and I can't reproduce it.
Really?
Yeah.
We definitely.
I can show you the data, but I don't see it.
It prolongs the action potential acute administration of estrogen.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. So if that.
I've read that literature avidly, with great interest, and I'm still scratching my head about it.
If you accept that. So you have suppression of IKR and enhancement of the calcium.
Testosterone has an effect on IKR. It's not, the literature is very confused here. And it does increase IKR and IK1, presumably. But it's not acute either, and it's not, doesn't increase copy number. So it's a very confusing result. So they haven't found more message. But for estrogen, it's a Japanese group that first reported that in research, and they said that in the guinea pig, there is a direct effect of estrogen at the pore region of IKR, of the HERG channel protein. And they even identified the peptides, the amino acid sequence, where estrogen acts. And they mutated them, and they said, aha, if you mutate them, estrogen can't do that anymore. So we looked at their data, and we saw that they were adding industrial concentrations of estrogen. But then they have other pieces of information where they added as little as 10 nanomolar estrogen. 10 nanomolar estrogen is fairly high for most animal species, including men, except when you're in pregnancy. Then you're protected, and it goes in the 100 nanomolar range. But here, when we try to repeat this, we didn't see it. Now, the pore region in the guinea pig, where they did the experiment, and the rabbit are the same. There's a complete homology, and we didn't see anything. I don't know what
we
to tell you.
We've seen it with 1 nanomolar estrogen on human cells. The very sort of reproducible.
I've seen it on the L current on human cells. We published that recently in the Biology of Sex Differences, where you use human stem cells, you treat them with estrogen, the females have an increased L current, an increased NCX, but not the males. So, I don't know. All right, so these experiments here that I'm switching to are to tell you what the contribution of bradycardia alone is on the heart. Why bradycardia? Where does this come from? Where it comes from is that if you read a little bit the clinical literature, you find that there is a great risk for women who have a reduced rate, heart rate, due to valve surgeries, supraventricular surgeries, any number of conditions where the result of coming out of the surgery, they have heart rates below the normal, so the heart rate falls in the 60 and 50 beats per minute range. And the clinicians immediately put a pacemaker on them. They put a pacemaker because they are at risk of lethal tachyarrhythmias as a result of bradycardia alone. And they don't do that with men. And they don't know why. But that's what they do. Okay? I mean, that's... So here's an example of a set of experiments where we go from a slow heart rate to a basic heart rate. The slow heart rate is 50 beats a minute, and the basic heart rate is 120. And so we're doing this for a certain duration, let the system settle, go to the basic heart rate, let the system settle, and go back and forth. And you can do this for a long time. So these experiments take, 35 minutes, roughly, for just this sequence of data that you see here. And so what happens to the actual potential duration is that it goes up. This is how long it takes to settle. And then we go back to the to the basic heart rate. And then it goes down at faster heart rates. And it goes back and forth. And these are example of actual potential durations taken from point A, B, point C, and so on. And you can see the short, long, short, long. And what happens here is that if you look at a pseudo-EKG of the heart, is that the T wave that you pick up here changes in its amplitude and increases when you're at slow rate. Now, the magnitude of the T wave, and this is shown here, T wave to QRS amplitude, it's the ratio. So you measure the amplitude of the T wave relative to the QRS amplitude, is a measure of the dispersion of repolarization in the heart. And this is also a clinical trick because physicians have access to EKG data. And when they see the T wave abnormally large, it's a sign of increased dispersion or repolarization abnormality. And if you now plot this, is at least six rabbits, QT interval, measuring the prolongation as a result of slow heart rate, and the change in QT interval telling us that there's an increase in dispersion of repolarization. And this is why that early slide, I said to get it to our side, you have a dispersion of repolarization and you need a trigger. And bradycardia alone produces that dispersion. You don't even need to add IKR to get that. And this is the actual recordings of action potentials, fast heart rate, slow heart rate. This is calcium. This is voltage. These are recorded simultaneously. And these are examples of how the calcium transient, look at that, it goes up, it starts to go down, then it hangs. And as you go slower, this is the time course, because it doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes a few, 10 or 12 beats for this to settle, and you see this increase in action potential duration, in calcium transient duration, and in action potential duration. And if you do a calcium transient duration as a function of time, this is how it varies, and this is how the APD varies, and the two remain highly correlated. And you sort of expect that. Here, we reverse the process. We go from slow back to fast. This is the same heart. And you see the calcium. Notice the diastolic resting concentration of calcium rises. And as you slow down, it goes down. It comes back up. The baseline for the voltage is stable. It doesn't change with rate. And that's how a voltage-sensitive dye should record and report that information to you, as well as the calcium information regarding diastolic calcium. And now you reverse the process relating calcium transient duration as a function of time, APD as a function of time, and again, their correlation.
Can you comment on the time constant of 10 seconds there?
It's actually beats. it's 10 to 12 beats, heart rates, yeah. Heart beats.
So is that something which...
You see this in the staircase effect as well, the Bowditch effect. When you change rate, you see an increase in force, and this increase in force has been reported in the 1700s as a function of rate.
So the pacing cyclones is the slow pacing cyclones is what?
The slow is 50.
Leon wants to know the time. Because 10 beats, if you pacing a second, is 10 seconds.
Right, so you can translate that. But asking about time is not a good way to ask it, because it depends on what rates you're changing, from what rate to what rate you're varying. That will vary the time. So there's not a single time constant that I can tell you that will express how the system adjusts. But if you look at one rate to another rate, the system adjusts fairly quickly in about 10 to 12 beats. And that's the same that's been found in the Bowditch effect, the staircase effect. So what I'm saying here is nothing I invented. This is fairly established. Yeah?
Are you going to talk at all about the relationship between the hump on the calcium and the hump on the duration?
Yeah.
Right,
but I got to get you warmed up first. In other words, if I show you humps on the calcium transient and I proclaim this hump is this, you're not going to believe it until... I wouldn't believe it until you see the careful, detailed workup on what that signal is being measured with the kind of accuracy and precision. Because otherwise, a hump is a hump, and I would be skeptical. Does that... Okay, I don't mean to... Okay. All right, so this is a region of the heart. We look at position A, B, and C along the heart to look at dispersion of repolarization and whether dispersion of repolarization is in fact occurring, because before that I just showed you one pixel. And so if you look at site A, site B, and site C, look, site A, which is near the base, has much more of this hump. And here I don't see that hump. So I am going to talk a lot about this hump. And why does this happen? Is that basically the biggest differences that occur are changes in action potential duration between the right ventricular base and the left ventricular atrium. So this is where the biggest differential occurs between APD magnitude in the heart. Now, is this totally unexpected? No. People have studied the right ventricular outflow tract as a source of arrhythmias for a long, long time. This is not particularly new. What is new here is how bradycardia alone causes this dispersion and the reason for this dispersion. That's what's new. In that, at the molecular level, that you have a control, an upregulation by estrogen, as we'll push on. So those effects are quite large. Now, we wanted to see what is happening at the cellular level. So here what we have is, you see the heart is in this horizontal chamber, and we can now use a 40x water immersion lens to look at a spot here, which is 150 by 150 micrometer, or a spot here at the apex, to see what the cells are doing. This is an image from the CMOS camera that is actually doing these measurements. And you can see now you have fibers that are aligned, and this is not confocal. So the depth of field of the lens is about 2.9 micrometer. That's the information that you get from the Nikon energy transfer function for the lens, for the objective, that you can get from the manufacturer. To what extent do you believe that number? You got to check it. And there are ways in which you can check the energy coming to your camera by having an LED and a light spot and varying the Z-axis, and then you can get the distribution of energy that reaches your camera. And so 2.9 is too optimistic in most cases because it's affected by the index of refraction of your solution between the lens and the heart. That has an impact on what energy transfer function you're going to read. And so 2.9 is an ideal condition that we did not meet. This is more like 4.2 micron. So from this, that tells you that this lens is not looking at a 1 micron slice across the cells, because now what we can do is present this data as a line scan on a confocal, because everybody is familiar with that. And so here you have a line scan from A to A prime, that would be this line here along this axis for this cell. Now we're getting all of that information, but here we show just AA prime at the basic heart rate. And at the basic heart rate, each signal here is now being recorded by a pixel, and the pixel is 1.5 by 1.5 micron. And the scan rate is 500 frames a second. So that's the limitation, and that's your noise level. And you see this scan, now you slow down heart rate, and 1 minute later, you can see that the activation times are now longer, the cycle length is longer, and you see this hump. 3 minutes later, it gets more accentuated. Now, if you do the same thing at this site, you see essentially no effect in basic heart rate versus slow heart rate. So this effect is not seen at the apex.
I use an inner coupler, mechanical, electrical.
So mechanical and couplers, we've used without. In this case, we used blebbistatin, but I must tell you that we only use it at 5 micromolar for about 5 minutes, and then we wash it off. We don't leave it on. And we use the lowest concentration that people have reported. Because if we use our immobilization chamber at the macroscopic level, we can stop everything. We don't need blebbistatin. But here there's motion within the fibers, and at that magnification, we would have more noise here. It's a good point. But we are very cautious with it.
Keith, yeah. What would be, if you were to sum up over the entire field of view, the signal, and plotted it in the same way, would you see the same kind of action potential?
Oh, for this region? At the macroscopic level? Yeah, you would notice this.
So it would look, the APs would look the same, right?
The what?
I'm just trying to, like the pictures that you would show would be kind of the same if you were to sum all the pixels up.
Yeah. Well, it depends on how big a summation. If you go too far, you might not. I will go back to this issue in a minute, because one of the things we try to do here is to go macroscopic imaging to subcellular imaging, and try to identify zones of activity that differ from the other parts in the heart.
Are you scoping the objective, or how do you go macro?
Basically, there's a camera, a 35mm Nikon camera versus this Olympus 40X water immersion. It's not a trivial switch right now, but it's not impossible. It's not terrific, but it's okay.
So in panel 3, so Karishima activation takes almost like 50 milliseconds, right? Do you know that delay?
What 50 milliseconds?
Activation of Karishima, panel 3 in the right part.
You mean the rise time?
The third one, 3 meters.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, this one?
Yeah.
This one.
Activation
is
taking almost
So we have measured this in other experiments in detail, not in this one necessarily, but we had measured 25 plus or minus 3 or 4 in the calcium signal rise time. And so I don't recall that we did that again here. So 50 is a little long. It should be less. Yeah. It's typically in the 25 plus or minus 4 milliseconds. And we had done this in detail before, but we didn't repeat that here.
So what you're saying, the delay is between the action potential and the calcium?
There's no action potential here. I mean, I haven't...
But your blue trace does not coincide with the calcium.
Oh, this one.
Well, it's the next more, one. The next one, the next one, it's even more. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't...
Yeah, I think it's just the I think it's just the slide where we didn't align it properly. Right. I don't know. Sometimes you label it and then you move something and it's I think it's a craftsmanship problem when making the slide, not a real problem. Okay, so here we record line scans along the fiber axis AA prime versus transverse. And what we are trying to do in this particular slide, see that damn battery did die on me, is that this secondary elevation of calcium. He brought me batteries. I'm lucky. Change batteries. An equipment timeout. So what we wanted to do in this particular case is try to understand the features of the secondary elevation of calcium. The secondary elevation of calcium being here the first, and then finally this, and then the second here. And now you also have, if you notice, diastolic calcium of waves. And the diastolic calcium waves are observed here. And also here. And so if you now map activation time of the secondary, it's all comes out together. So all the cells, all the release units are synchronous. They kick open together. And if you go in this direction, still pretty synchronous, but less so. That's in the B to B prime direction. But along the axis of the cell, they appear very synchronous. And maybe I can show you this. And you see the second one is synchronous. The dot here represents the spot where this is being recorded. And so you have the primary one, the paste release, and then you have another synchronous blip, and then you have the waves.
So what's producing the waves?
These waves here?
You don't have E431 here, these are just normal. So you have calcium waves in the rabbit heart.
No. This is abnormally slow rate. 50?
Okay, so it's a rate. This is a okay.
It's just the rate.
Are you gonna show us a faster rate moving or other results?
If you go back too fast they go away. Yeah, they're rate dependent, and so what you surmise that I'm going to say is basically what you said in your talk, that when you have a prolongation of action potential duration, NCX activates during the plateau phase, and it's electrogenic, so it holds the action potential plateau more positive longer, more L current comes in, more calcium floods the system, and okay, you can repolarize. But the next beat, it gets worse. And so you have a positive feedback effect. The more L current you have coming in because of voltage-dependent inactivation has not shut it down, the more NCX turns on, and you get a nasty positive feedback loop system. And that saturates the system with calcium at low rates. And that's why low rates are arrhythmogenic. In essence, that's the answer to this. So in this particular experiment, we again look at the rate dependence, and we're looking along this axis. And you see here very strong diastolic waves in this particular. And this is an example of voltage and calcium recording under control conditions. We are able to measure voltage at 1.5 micron spatial resolution. Now, we look at actual potential durations from the left ventricular apex and the right ventricular base. And at this point, you see the control plus the ranitidine receptor stabilizer K201. At the apex, no effect. But at the base, as the actual potential duration gets longer, if you have K201, you stop that. So rate gives you a certain amount of APD. And by subduing the release of calcium, you're subduing the effect of NCX and subduing the excessive feedback prolongation. And another way to slow down RYR2, and this was at the time when John Norman was pushing flecainide as a therapy for CPVT. And K201 is an RYR2 stabilizer that was developed by Andy Marks at Columbia University, which essentially doesn't shut down RYR2, but makes it less active or less likely to reopen. So the lack of reopening is basically this hump on the calcium transients, which you saw a lot of in these slides. And so K201 is shortening this by subduing this secondary calcium release, which I argued legs are doing that. Which I argued is synchronous. So flecainide has a similar effect as K201, and I understand that flecainide also has an effect on the sodium current. So sometimes I just take it out and not bother to show it for that reason. Okay, so now if you look at...
Can I stop you here? Can you go back to the slide where you have both the single cell and the transverse recording? It's about three slides back. Yeah, right there. So it looks like you're getting regional sort of clustering of waves, right, in your B prime to B.
Yeah.
As if there are hotspots or, you know, clusters of cells that are susceptible to wave formation. In other words, it's not random. Is that generally true? Is that an interesting issue?
What we try to do is, let's say, can I predict this spot on the heart is going to start, right, sending me off EADs? I can't predict that from heart to heart. And all I can do is tell you the approximate region where they tend to occur.
But this is a common finding, this clustering, or is this unusual?
This clustering, well, this is mainly... In the region that is coming out synchronously, and now is the whole heart doing this? No, only the base is more likely to do this than the apex. And if I focus with my 40x water immersion lens in different regions, I see this often. It's not hard to find.
So the thing is, like, this is about 150 microns, right?
Yeah. And the camera is 100 by 100 pixels.
One cell is the one that, it seems like it's just one cell, the one driving this kills.
This one? Yeah, no, this is several cells. No, but if you go to AA prime, they're all doing it. They're all doing it. But if you go in there, sorry?
And if you go AA prime, is that one cell?
AA prime, yeah, most likely.
Yeah, right. One cell.
Most likely
one cell is the one driving on these things, right?
No, I'm showing you one cell, but I have the whole field.
Oh, so C is the whole field, right?
No. Oh, yeah, C is the whole field. Yes.
So to me, it seems like one and two.
It's several cells,
yeah. Sure. So the question, question for Mandy is like, is what one thing is very small area, right? So when you focus on the upper part of the card, and you, how often when you focus on 150 microns, how often do you see this? It's all the
really
time?
Nearly all the time, yeah.
Yeah, so there's really a lot of these cells.
There's a lot of those, yeah. In bradycardia, yes. It's not that the others might be, so that's, okay. So this is an example of a bradycardia-induced triggered activity. And this sequence of experiments, the sequence in this protocol is you have a basic heart rate, a slow heart rate, and this is now minutes. This is 25 minutes. And at this point, we add K201. So if you look at the B, which is the three-minute position here, at this time point, you see voltage calcium, and then it starts to fire extra beats. And these extra beats, essentially, it depends on how long you stay in this bradycardia. It doesn't happen right away. It takes time. So now if you go to the 8-minute mark, where we've gone to the basic heart rate, they go away. This is the 8-minute time point. If you now go back here to the 13-minute time point along this scale, you see now more and more of these beats, these extra beats. And at 18 minutes, we are recording here, after 1 micromolar of K201, the ryanodine receptor stabilizer. And that point, they go away. And if I go to the 25-minute, which is here at slow rates, they don't come back.
Here, so, for a person who doesn't know what K201 is, what does that mean? Ryanodine receptor stabilizer, but in terms of currents.
So
activation, what does it do?
The ryanodine receptor stabilizer is a strong concept that is being sought after by a lot of pharmaceutical companies as a heart failure therapy. And the reason for that is it is thought that when the ryanodine receptor is confronted with a high calcium concentration outside, the SR in the cytosol, and a high concentration of calcium in the lumen of the SR, is activated and it reopens without getting a voltage trigger. It's opening out of phase, right? And it's opening because of the ionic concentrations that exist. That's what turns it on. Whereas what you want to happen, and what in a normal healthy situation happens, you have a voltage trigger, and the voltage trigger puts an injection of L current into the dyadic zone, and the ryanodine receptor opens, and only opens then, and then shuts down. If it starts to open out of phase, that's very dangerous. That's why you get these kinds of blips. And if you now shut down those events, those reopenings of the ryanodine receptor, in other words, you want to suppress the ryanodine receptor, but not all the time, only when it's acting out of phase. So the stabilizer is supposed to, I guess, protect the ryanodine receptor from opening, perhaps, because of luminal concentrations of calcium. And when they are high, that opens the iodine receptor. It stops that function of the iodine receptor. Exactly how they work, we don't know. Flecainide also does that. There are other agents that appear to work this way. They don't block the normal opening of the iodine receptor. Does that help?
Somewhat.
Okay. Well, we can talk about this one later if you want.
Maybe you said this. Are these an adult female? Or?
Yes. Oh, sorry. These are adult females past puberty. Yes. Yeah.
One quick technical question. So I assume you were late, yes, you know, to go to slow pacing, right?
So, we have to stay. Otherwise, it's hard. And you also have to select what rate carefully. If you go too slow, you get spontaneous beads.
But we're seeing sometimes maybe some of those may come from
No, just a second. I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'll show you where they come from. Here are pace beads, and these are extraneous beads. And you can see that the pace bead is from my electrode, and you can see waves of activation that are very clear. And then the ectopic beads coming from the base over here.
So could it be
These are different.
But could it be from a Purkinje?
From a what?
Purkinje fiber. Just fiber.
Not at those rates. They're slow. Right. The Purkinje fiber would poof. When Purkinjes are active, they depolarize much faster. The speed would be much faster, and it also wouldn't propagate here. Look at this propagation wave from this side to here, and at site A you can see that calcium precedes voltage, and in this one voltage precedes calcium as it should. So that's the difference between them as well. If the Purkinje is depolarized here, once it depolarizes, then all of that wave would follow a normal EC coupling routine. It doesn't. This is a calcium triggered.
And it's a dual camera setup, right?
Sorry?
This is with a dual camera setup for both
channels. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So spatial alignment goes pixel to pixel.
Yep. We can talk about that as well. Sure. But okay. So let me get back to long QT. So here's long QT. Here's the heart. We're looking at this area. And we're looking at a number of sites here that are shown as A, B, and C. And I'm superimposing the calcium transients from these sites at different time points. I'm showing you the map at point 1, point 2, and at point 3. At this position in time, this is just the calcium transients. This is calcium and voltage. And if you look at when the calcium rises, it holds over, starts to recover, and then comes back up, right, in this zone. And the voltage follows through, goes down, and starts to level off here. And the time delay here is 14 milliseconds. And we've done a lot of experiments looking at the initiation of the arrhythmia to look at how these calcium oscillations impact the voltage. And in this case, this is an E4031 blockade of IKR. And this is the initiation of what's happening to the long QT and the torsade of the point. And what you see is that there are certain hotspots. This is this zone here that you see here, And this is not microscopic, this is macroscopic still, right? So that these zones here of calcium rising before the voltage are specks of the range of the millimeter in size. There isn't necessarily only one. There's often maybe a few of them that occur. And now as you go in time past this kickback, which initiates the different elevations of calcium. They spread out, and then over here, they become quite large. So what we are trying to do is capture what is the hotspot that I need to start the process. And I think this is exactly what Andy also suggested. So let me show you the movie of that, if I may. Calcium is on the left, and voltage is on the right. And that starts... So here it's a bit... So this is the macroscopic field of view, 15 by 15 millimeter.
Is this the raw data or your observation data?
This is pretty much raw data. So let's now look at it at the subcellular level. And at the subcellular level, you'll see first elevation of calcium, a secondary elevation, which is during the action potential plateau, and then you have diastolic waves, and those diastolic waves essentially could generate DADs, okay? Much like these generate EADs, these secondary calcium elevations. And so you see that in time, you go from an oral calcium transient to getting more and more pronounced humps, and these become much shorter, and the diastolic intervals are become almost negligible. And you can see here it never goes back to baseline, it fires again. And this is not very different from, I think, some of the things that were shown for heart failure. But here, this is all acute. There's been no, this is a matter of minutes from the time you perfuse the animal in a normal Ringer solution to a long QT2 solution. And then that's maybe 5 minutes, and you'll see the process and the progress of that.
What is subcellular calcium? Intracellular?
I'm sorry?
I don't understand what subcellular calcium.
Subcellular. Oh, what I mean by that is that experiment where I map 150 by 150 micrometer, and then I'm looking at a pixel, which is subcellular in nature.
But you mean in whole heart?
In the whole heart. So the cell is in the whole heart. It's coupled electrically, it's at 37, and it's at a controlled heart rate. Right, these are not isolated cells. They're all in the intact animals, in the intact heart, sorry. I'd like to keep the intact animal. I haven't done that yet. So this is a sequence of experiments. This is essentially A. Then you add E4031 to block IKR. The first thing you see is one extra beat. Then you see a complex series of oscillations. In other words, bigger and bigger secondary calcium release and diastolic waves, and then you have essentially a situation where it goes from many salvos of elevations of calcium, and eventually you don't even have a recovery to baseline, and you have the torsade. Okay? And so here what we can do is show you a movie of each step.
Each of those is calcium leading, during the oscillations, is calcium leading the voltage?
I don't have that to prove it to you.
But in your experience.
Oh, so this would lead the voltage, not this.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Just to be. But that's what you asked, I think. Yeah. So this is the expected. Oops. So what I mean by subcellular arcadi is that you can see the single cells here, and this is a pixel in that field of view. Okay? And again, you can see the fibers.
And you see contractions. There's a little motion right there. There's a little motion.
There might be, yeah. So you're getting more and more complicated patterns. And it's very hard to model all of these with standard models that have been so far published. So we looked at the Luvuridi model, the Mahajan model, and then the Shannon, Puglisi, and Bears model, which was designed specifically for... And here you have calcium and voltage. And so the thing to notice is that these calcium elevations occur before anything happens here. And this is the base, and this is the apex. Okay, so I need to finish. When we try to model these things that we saw here with the current models that are available, we totally failed. And so in this recent paper that appeared in Chaos, what we did is we modeled a system using a modified Shannon-Puglisi-Bears model where the ranidine receptor had three gates, an activation and inactivation gate that are sensitive to cytosolic calcium, and an inner gate that is sensitive to luminal calcium. And when we're able to do that, I'm not going to show the movies, as running out of time, then you could actually generate a lot of the patterns that we saw here. And we think that that's an important thing to consider when you model and you're trying to predict experimental data in a way that lines up with what we're able to see and observe. These are model descriptions. And I don't know if I should even show this, but you tell me what this is.
What is the size of this field?
This is 150 by 150 microns, the subcellular field, and this is calcium, and the heart is under fibrillation.
This is experiment.
Yeah.
So if I miss which calcium I will use?
Road 2. I don't know how this happens. I certainly have no way to model that.
You look like a Mobley model that...
Anyway, I want to show you the people who did the work. Jeanne Wan did a lot of voltage clamp data. She did her PhD in my lab. This is Jung Kim and Jan Nemec. And this is Guo Zhongchen, who did a lot of stuff. Actually, I didn't show you his work on sodium-calcium exchanger. And Vladimir Schusterman. Some of you might know Vladimir. He is a modeler and a wonderful statistician. So we rely on him a lot to make sure we analyze our data appropriately. Thank you.
Please. Yeah, two questions. In your data, is the calcium leading the voltage depolarization in the EAD? So if the calcium is random, as we said before, so how random calcium will synchronize? What are your interpretation to the data that actually you can synchronize a very large area in the optical mapping you see there? what synchronized the calcium waves in these cells?
I showed you a figure where the voltage and calcium rise correctly.
Right.
The calcium goes back down and starts to rise back up. The time when this calcium rises back up is 190 milliseconds after the upstroke. And this is very reliable. It's rate dependent. It's not independent of that. But if you have the same rate, you're going to find the hot zones that start the EAD come back up 190 milliseconds. Why? I think it's because this is the time when you have released calcium, you started to reload the SR, and you can't reload the SR more, and you can't come back to baseline. And that's when the ryanodine receptor opens back up. And then zones where this happens, it comes back out synchronously. The calcium is not asynchronous, and it's not stochastic. It's in fact highly dependent and correlates with your pulse and your beat. And this is the interval of time it takes for the ryanodine receptor to quit and not able to take in more calcium and reopen. The stabilizers presumably work to stave off that point. Now, what they may do is just shift it a little bit, which may be enough for the system to recover. Or it may be that the distribution of when they come back, the ryanodine receptors reopen, is no longer so fixed, and they're distributed over a longer period of time, and so they don't open back up at the same time, and that protects. So those are the ways the K201 and the flecainide experiment may help stop the arrhythmia. But it's not that RYR2 is not stochastic, it's that we have synchronized it with the beat.
So I would comment that, I may drag Johannes into this question, because when we published our paper about synchronization during DADs, which is now quite a few years ago, we found that there is a clear timing issue, that cells will synchronize because of some natural loading, basically loading of the SR. So 190 milliseconds probably also reflects that the SR has reloaded to a point, meaning not so that it can fire completely, but then can, you know, you think of your three states of your antisense, right? We got two calcium sensitive states for release, one that's luminal and one that's cytoplasmic, right? So now those are being invoked in some balance, and this timing is not magical. It is magical in a sense, because you've restored enough calcium and enough excitability at 190 milliseconds, yeah. in so many cells that's how I would pick. Right. Johannes, you want to make a comment about that?
The synchronization is basically due to circa, which is essentially the time to recover to the threshold when you release calcium.
Right.
Pretty much the same for all the cells.
So the issue of circa is very important. In an experiment like this, we don't have a huge rundown. In heart failure, it may not work the same way because there is an energy deficit that is much more significant than in these hearts, because these hearts are pretty good shape. They last hours. And so circa is not rate limiting. And that's why there's a certain amount of, 190 is about the right amount of time when they will overload, with the luminal calcium being high, the cytosolic calcium never fully coming back down, because it only comes back down about halfway. So to us, halfway is that we have 380 nanomolar at diastolic calcium, 950, let's say 1 micromolar at peak. So halfway is a substantial amount of calcium in the 600 nanomolar range. That's outside. Now, I don't know what's in the dyadic region, but I don't think it's the dyadic region that's important, because the L current has shut its load, it's dissipated, and so probably it's close to the 600 nanomolar range. Inside the SR is the problem. And that's why it takes time for this secondary elevation to kick up. It doesn't happen instantaneously. It may take a minute or two. It may take six. It depends on the precise conditions.
So I know we're coming to the very end of the discussion because of time, and I don't want to predominate, but I want to point out that this has very important implications for the debate about whether EADs are an L-type calcium channel or a sodium calcium exchanger. And I assume you would argue that this is a sodium calcium exchange current.
I didn't show all the data we have
on this. That's fine. But this is a kind of an issue that's been going on for, 25 years, and it doesn't seem to be solved. Do you think this might be sort of model specific, or do you think in general EADs are a calcium driven phenomenon?
I think in general they're calcium driven.
I would agree with you, but there's a lot, L-type calcium channel, as we discovered, right. we didn't talk about it at all, the L-type calcium channel recovers incredibly fast.
Yeah.
I mean, 40, 50 milliseconds, a tau of 40 or 50 milliseconds to 37, at least in the dog atrium and ventricle, and I assume other species as well.
The bleeding recovers from an activation.
Pardon me?
It recovers from an activation.
Yes, recovers from an activation. It's very fast.
But at which voltage does it recover?
We did it at 50, 30, minus 50, minus 30, and minus 10 in the atrium. It's incredibly fast. And so, it's not without some merit to think of that you have a reactivation with L-type calcium channels, but I don't think that's the driver. I agree that it's not the driver.
Yeah, I don't think it is. It's been a long road to discuss this, and Jim Weiss has been pushing for the window current for a long time, and how to manipulate the L channel to change the window current by molecular manipulations and to stop EADs that way and arrhythmias that way, which is an attractive idea. But I think if you did stop window current, the calcium window current, you wouldn't stop this still. It would still happen.
Do
you think
about
L-type versus sodium calcium?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to say it's one or the other, because really the exchange current has the property is when your voltage go higher, it will change to the reverse mode. So it's not tend to promote the EAD when voltage is high. So when voltage really depolarizes high, you really need to reactivate the calcium channel. So the exchange play a very important role when the voltage is low. You hold the voltage there, push the voltage up. And then L-type channel actually gets in to push. It's in particular when the EADs it's lower, it's like minus 50.
But there is a difference between the two processes, because in one process you would get EADs without any calcium elevation, without any abnormalities in calcium. Whereas in the case where the calcium is the leading or the initiation of the EAD, you have to have calcium elevation, otherwise you don't get the EAD, and then you activate the NCX because of calcium. So the two are somewhat different, and the issue is not to be picky about is it this or that. Okay, maybe it doesn't matter, but if you're going to look for heart failure targets, because EADs are prominent in arrhythmias in patients with heart failure, and it is an important thing to suppress. And you need to know which way to go. And that's, so if you go with a rhythmic receptor stabilizer, which is what some people have actually taken them to clinical trial, this is not a joke, people have invested a lot of money on those. They had other problems because they affect other channels. I can go over the details. We are very careful about how much K201 we use, and we've checked that K201 doesn't affect the L current directly or K currents directly. in these models. And I don't know what happens in the humans, why they stop the trials, but that's another issue.
Second speaker again. Okay. 10 minutes for the next talk.